from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South.
But it was a fairy tale book to me, straight from the big screen of a Disney movie. I imagine Moses must have felt exactly as I did at the moment he was handed the Ten Commandments.
Recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Hanging down below the trailer were two very nice silver chains with hooks. Nobody had noticed them before. I thought about confessing right then, but that didn't seem like a great idea at the time.
Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story, as if they were sitting on the porch with you.
I'm sure I will receive a phone call from some unhappy driver. And though Lowe's undoubtedly would have sold me an extended warranty on the canopy, collision was not an option they offered.
So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Yeah, 2 year old stomping grand. Whoa, and knock three times. And if you don't hear a say, you nowhere to find me. It's one bar tab, yeah. Nowhere to find me. It's one bar tab.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like Salty Dogs? Hailing from the streets of Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs have incorporated hip sounds into their own blend of feel-good country music. Along with recording with rock and roll legend DJ Fontana, the Salty Dogs have won multiple awards, and their music has received kudos from Deke Dickerson to Jason Ringenberg and has been featured on the TLC network hit show Trading Spaces. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week's stories are all about best laid plans, as our writers all start out with a good plan, but things quickly change. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Peter O'Connell's master plan seems to be golden, but one false move and it begins to unravel. And we'll end the night with Mark Isbell as his money-saving ploy is taken over by unforeseen forces. But let's start the night with Wayne Ball as he devises a plan that he thinks will change everything in The Secret.
Even though no one had told me otherwise, I knew it was wrong to leave school alone. But one day at lunch in 1958, I knew it was my big day. I was in the fourth grade in Marlow, Oklahoma, and I crossed the street pretending to go to the snack shed, but I kept on going. I had to be back before lunch was over, so I kept a brisk pace for several blocks to the east until it seemed about right, and then turned to the north and walked along the jagged and uneven sidewalks forced upward and cracked by enormous tree roots shading white clapboard bungalows until I reached the library. This was going to work. I vividly recall from that time overhearing my mother brag to her friends, both in person and over the telephone, about my older brother and sister and their scores on the achievement test annually administered by the schools. I cannot remember the specifics, but it was something to the effect that my older sister, who was in the 7th grade, was reading at the level of 11th grade second semester, and my older brother, who was in the 10th grade, was reading at a second year college level. I'd taken achievement tests too, and never, not once, did I hear my mother mention that I'd even taken the test or at which level I was reading. I drew the obvious conclusion. My scores must have been bad, or she would have mentioned me too. After being admitted from her boasting time and time again, I devised a secret master plan to obtain the recognition I deserved. Marlow, Oklahoma at the time was a small farm town in central Oklahoma and was much like Mayberry was depicted. Life was slow in Marlow and the streets were safe. A family that lived across the street from the elementary school had a small shed-like building with awnings they would lift during recess and lunch. They stocked it with candy and Cokes, which were offered to students during lunch and recess. If you were fortunate enough to have money, for 5 cents you could get a large grape sucker. For 25 cents you could get a Frito pie. We had to cross the street without teacher supervision to get there, but no teacher ever complained, and it seemed entirely normal for students to leave the school grounds alone as an alternative to lunch in the school cafeteria. On this particular day, my plan consisted of going past the snack shed and heading instead to the town library. I had been to the library before. My mother would drive there on Saturdays. My older brother and sister had library cards and could check out books and read them and return them later. The library was in a large building about 3 blocks to the east and 6 to 10 blocks north of school. I had a good idea how to get there. I knew the library had books there, and for me to demonstrate my advanced reading skills, I had to gain access to more sophisticated books. Books even more sophisticated than the ones my brothers and sisters read. It was hard to walk unnoticed into the library. The creaky wooden floors echoed through the racks of books. After roaming the stacks searching for the book I was looking for, I realized I was going to need help finding it. The librarian was sitting behind a large oak desk. I stood sheepishly in front of her, and she finally stood, bent forward, and asked me in a hoarse whisper what I wanted. "I want the hardest book to read that you have here," I asked. "What?" she said with a puzzled look on her face. Apparently she did not understand what I was asking at first, but I'd come to the library intending to find the most difficult book to read that they had in the entire library. I repeated my desire, and I ultimately succeeded in making my request clear. She looked mad and seemed to stomp off, returning with a large leather-bound book. It was old, with little patches of leather flaking off. Even though she gently placed it on an oak library table, a small cloud of dust seemed to rise around it. It was not what I expected. I'd never seen a book like that before, but still, it looked like a treasure to me. I pushed a chair to the table and climbed in. I sat on the front edge of the seat. My toes just touched the floor. "Be careful with that," she said. "It's very old." And it was. It smelled old. The pages were brown and brittle. But it was a fairy tale book to me, straight from the big screen of a Disney movie. It was like the roof opened up and a ray of sunshine beamed down in front of me. I imagine Moses must have felt exactly as I did at the moment he was handed the Ten Commandments. This was the instant I would amaze my mother and her friends with my brilliance and prove to myself that I deserved to be bragged about. Very much aware of the librarian's warning, and knowing that she was likely watching me, I carefully opened the book and turned the brittle pages that almost creaked as I flipped them. I guess I thought I was going to read the entire book during my lunch hour. Looking back, I'm not sure if I'd studied Roman numerals at that time, but even if I had, I did not have the skills to interpret the ones I saw. I hurriedly glanced at the introduction, but it did not make much sense, so I moved on searching for the first chapter. But there was no first chapter. What I found was labeled Book One and started. My eyes focused on the line one of Book One. It made no sense to me. None at all. Almost every word was one that I'd never seen before. Big words, words foreign to me. I tried phonetically to pronounce them to myself, my lips attempting to mouth the sounds, but they were nonsense, unlike anything I'd seen before. I turned the page and started again. It made no difference. No matter where I started, I could not grasp what the author intended to convey. I could not string together the words of a single sentence. It was suddenly clear to me why my mother did not mention me to her friends. I was an idiot. The dumb child. I'm not sure how long I sat there, steeping in disappointment and failure, my face hot and red. I was embarrassed, sick to my stomach. I just wanted to get out of there. I left the book on the table and told the librarian I was through. My absence from school was never noticed. I made it back quietly and eased in with my classmates. I never told a soul about slipping off to the library. I did not want to admit that I was too stupid to read a book like the ones I imagined my brothers and sisters read. This was something better left unsaid. Maybe no one would notice. No one but me knew my secret. I never realized any difference until years later when I was in law school. After grades were posted, I had the third highest average, and many other students started treating me as if I was smart. I had trouble accepting their conduct. They were wrong. They did not know my secret, which I never told anyone until now. I've never attempted to read Plato's Republic again. Never wanted to, and I doubt I ever will. It still makes me sick to my stomach.
Wayne Ball currently resides in Little Rock, Arkansas, where he dreams of retiring from the practice of law to write, read poetry, and travel. In our next story, Peter O'Connell's plan to pack up and move from Virginia to Arkansas looks good on paper, but things quickly get away from him in Is That Your Truck?
The second rain shower of the day came as we rushed to pack the 26-foot U-Haul truck with all of my mom and dad's worldly possessions. We were already behind schedule, and the rain wasn't helping. I probably should have taken the rain as a sign to slow down and make sure I had everything secure, but I didn't, a mistake I would pay dearly for later in the end. I was excited and a little nervous. After 3 years in a headquarters job in Virginia, the Air Force was sending me back to Little Rock to fly the C-130. Living 10 minutes from my mom and dad in Virginia with all the grandchildren had been a blessing for all of us, and they had asked us if it would be okay if they moved with us to Arkansas. I figured, why not? My friend Alan and I packed the last box into the U-Haul while my mom carefully stacked all of her favorite potted plants full to the ceiling in the cab of my dad's prized little blue Chevy S10 pickup truck. Dad barely had room to squeeze in and drive it onto the two-wheeled trailer behind the U-Haul. Alan and I tightened the web straps around the front wheels. Now, we were pilots, not car people, so it was amazing we got the truck secured and the trailer lights hooked up and working. Dad locked the doors to his mobile greenhouse and proclaimed in his Boston accent, "We're ready to go." We finished the pre-departure rituals, sending the kids and Grandpa to the bathroom one more time, said goodbye, and settled into our spots in the five-vehicle caravan that I'd be leading for the next 1,000 miles. 5 o'clock rush hour traffic made it hard to stay together, but my wife Peggy stayed right behind me in the minivan. I was glad I didn't have her job. Our 2-year-old girls were strapped uncomfortably into their car seats, covered with chicken pox, talking nonstop, and still potty training. If she got distracted and missed a turn, we'd never see her again. Amazingly, all 4 vehicles stayed together as we made the turn onto US Highway 58, heading past Suffolk, the peanut capital of the world, and through the Great Dismal Swamp, a giant forested wetland that stretches halfway into North Carolina. Hey, maybe this wasn't going to be so hard after all. Logging trucks full of freshly harvested yellow pine trees jammed the highway. I glanced at the plaster cast on my right forearm, a painful reminder of my trying to help my aunt cut down a tree the week before. The chainsaw spinning wildly above my head as I fell to the ground was still a vivid memory. Just one more thing making this a challenging move. Peggy flashed her headlights, signaling that she needed to stop. We'd only been driving for an hour, but I guessed the girls needed to do the potty thing. So I pulled the entire entourage into the big Exxon truck stop in Emporia for a quick stop, which took way too long. We picked up Highway 58 for the 38-mile leg to South Hill, heading for Interstate 85 into North Carolina. It was a nice semi-divided four-lane with grass medians and lots of roads and driveways entering and crossing from each side. Now, you're probably wondering why I'm telling you about the highway, but that will become pretty clear pretty soon. Just as I started to think we might make it to Charlotte, the wall of water from a black thunderstorm engulfed the rolling hills we were driving on. I slowed down to about 30 miles an hour, straining to see lights behind me, but it was no use. Then, just as quickly, we popped out the other side into the beautiful green rolling hills and drove on for another 20 minutes. I released the death grip on the steering wheel just as a blue car came alongside with the driver honking at me and pointing back at the U-Haul. What now, I thought. I eased over onto the shoulder and glanced back. Yep, red van, white car, big U-Haul truck, all lined up behind me. I got out of the Honda and walked back, mentally checking each car and telling everyone to just hang on as I walked back to talk with my dad. He climbed down out of the truck and walked to the back. Then we saw the problem. Where's the truck? I asked my dad as I stared at the empty trailer. He couldn't see the trailer through his mirrors, so he didn't really know, and even worse, had no idea how long I'd been missing. The truck is gone, I blurted out as we ran back to the cars. Confusion turned to horror on everyone's face when they realized I was talking about the little blue truck. You guys stay here, we'll be back. My dad and I sped off heading east, retracing the road we had just come down. I scanned left, looking down the westbound legs. No truck. 30 miles back to Emporia, I guessed. We drove in silence, afraid to say anything, until we heard the siren. An ambulance pulled out in front of us, heading eastbound. Oh God, we've killed somebody, I said under my breath. Dad wasn't much for public prayer normally, but he said we probably should say one now. I just knew that the truck had run into someone and we were driving back into a disaster. 10 more minutes of silence until we crested the top of the hill and saw the flashing lights about a half mile in front of us. There was the blue pickup truck. But it was on the right side of the highway, sitting perfectly still and upright in the middle of some guy's front yard, heading east. Blue and yellow lights flashed from a state police car and a tow truck. So we glided up in front of the house. The Virginia trooper, the wrecker driver, and a couple of other men, I guess the owners of the house, were standing in the yard talking and looking at the truck. My dad and I got out of the car slowly, hopped across the shallow drainage ditch that separated the yard from the road. We eased our way towards the group, trying to appear like we had just stopped because we were curious. Hey there, what happened? I asked innocently. The trooper was skeptical. Is that your truck? He asked. My dad scratched his chin, looked over at the blue truck that was 20 feet from the house and wedged on the only 12-inch steel rod on the property. Well, it kind of looks like it, my dad told him, and walked over to inspect it. The windows were black, plants and dirt everywhere. Dad pulled out the key and unlocked the door. I glanced over at the four men watching us in disbelief. My dad pushed the plants out of the driver's seat, climbed in, and started the engine. Well, there was no denying it was our truck now. I guess there's no damage, Dad told the trooper. I was pretty sure the trooper's manual never covered anything like this. He looked at the man whose front yard had received the wayward truck and asked, "What do you think?" Man just shrugged and said, "Well, no real damage, just a couple of ruts in the yard." We nodded. Then we thanked everyone and backed off before anyone could figure out how the pickup had slid off the trailer, drifted to the right, glanced off a small bush, and then crossed four lanes of highway in the middle of a thunderstorm before it jumped the little ditch and ran into that solitary pole. We'd been gone over an hour when we got back to the rest of the family. As we pulled up behind the U-Haul, the tension and worry on their faces changed to that same look of disbelief that the state trooper had. I was too emotionally spent to explain what had happened, so for the second time that day, Dad drove the little blue truck onto the trailer, and I wrapped the mesh webs around the tires. "Double wrap the safety chains around the axle this time," Dad yelled out the window. "Safety chains?" Yep. Hanging down below the trailer were two very nice silver chains with hooks. Nobody had noticed them before. I thought about confessing right then, but that didn't seem like a great idea at the time. I don't remember much about where we stayed that night or the rest of the drive, but by the time we reached our new home in Arkansas, the story of the little blue truck that refused to die had become an epic. That truck was battle-scarred and a full member of our family for as long as my dad could keep it running. And he did for a long time.
Peter O'Connell retired from the Air Force but still trained C-130 pilots. He and his wife Peggy lived across the South and raised their four children in Arkansas. Peter does not own a pickup truck. In our final story of the night, Mark Isbell devises a great plan to save money, but as these things often do, it doesn't exactly go the way he envisioned it in The Thing About Shade.
It costs $39.28 per day to rent a set of chairs and a beach umbrella at the Portofino Island Beach Resort. 4 days of rental, then, would result in a fee of close to $160. Nearly, although not quite twice as much, as the $89 I paid for the 8x10 Garden Treasures pop-up canopy at my neighborhood Lowe's store before I make the 10-hour trip from Arkansas to the Gulf Coast. Not only will my tent cast substantially more shade than the standard Portofino umbrella, but I will actually still own it at the end of our 4-day stay, and it will undoubtedly come in handy at some point in the future, or at least that is the plan. I haul it to the beach our first day there, out of the parking deck of our high-rise condo rental, through the meandering paths of the resort, across the highway, and down the beach, just beyond the line of umbrellas. There I stake our claim on our 80 square feet of sand and begin assembling the structure, which pops up in a snap, just as advertised. I then attach the canopy, and a few minutes later, my wife and I sit reading as our 2-year-old son sits safely in the shade, digging holes and pushing dump trucks. When we pack our books, toys, and towels to retire to the condo for the evening, we simply remove the canopy from our tent and leave the bones of the structure in place. But upon returning to our room and looking from our balcony out over the beach, I carefully note how the resort employees are packing away the chairs and umbrellas. Where once our tent stood inconspicuously, just one small structure amid so many others, it now towers prominently over the deserted beach, isolated, alone. Then I remember the beach cleaner, that oddity of implements pulled behind either a tractor or an ATV that wanders back and forth early in the morning, sifting through the sand to gather the previous day's detritus. In the early dawn, I imagine, the bones of our tent will not stand in too great of contrast against the morning sky and could potentially prove an unwelcomed obstacle. And so I make my way back out to the beach. My money-saving ploy, as they often do, is already creating considerably more work for me. To save a bit of time, I determine I would leave the structure erected, but move it to the fringe of the dunes that separate the highway from the beach, near where the resort employees lock away the chairs, umbrellas, and other rentals. It occurs to me, however, that if the resort has some issue with my storing my personal property here, they will have no way of knowing the tent belongs to me. So I stop at the front desk and borrow a magic marker before making my way back out across the sand. I write my name and phone number prominently on each leg of the tent and then proceed to carry it to the edge of the dunes. If you wish to collapse, pack up, and carry your 8x10 Garden Treasures canopy, the company makes it very easy for you by providing a carrying case complete with luggage wheels and a strap to pull it with. Partially erected, however, moving the canopy alone over any significant distance is no small feat, at least for a man of average height like myself. The most balanced grasping point is at the very peak of the structure, where all four of the diagonal cross members converge. And balance is important since any teetering to either side results in the legs of the tent digging into the sand, halting forward progress and threatening to damage the thin frame. But this grasping point requires me to raise one arm as high as possible while swinging the other to the side, a bit like the Statue of Liberty. The only other reasonable grasping method is to grasp two of the diagonal cross members directly across from one of the others, much like the Y formation and the YMCA dance. Eventually, I make my way through a mixture of the Statue of Liberty and the YMCA to the edge of the dunes, where I deposit our canopy for the night. I'm relieved the following morning when I step out onto the ninth floor balcony and look out to the beach, where I'm able to just make out the frame of our canopy, unadulterated by the night. My labor was not in vain. By 9 a.m., we have our tent back in place, canopy attached, and our patch of sand claimed for the day. My two-year-old son has never flown a kite, so I pull the one we purchased out of our beach bag, attach the string, and try to get it airborne. Nevertheless, the wind is incredibly mild, without even breeze enough to loft the kite. The thing about a two-year-old is that they can like something, even love it, and in a matter of minutes be so completely done with it and ready to move on to something else. So goes my son with the beach. Not 30 minutes into our morning, he turns and begins walking toward the condo, toys in hand, shuffling through the sand without saying a word. When we ask where he is going, he says, "I want to go pool," which is really awesome since we have a pool in our neighborhood back home in Arkansas, but no beach. The more we try to entice him to stay, the more adamant he becomes about going. Certain we will be back within the hour, we stow our chairs and the rest of his toys safely under the footprint of our canopy and make our way to the pool. The thing about the Gulf is how quickly the weather can change. Not 20 minutes are we in the pool before we hear the thunder in the distance. Not 5 minutes later and the wind is gusting north of 30 miles per hour. The thing about the Garden Treasures 8x10 canopy is it makes one heck of a kite. As we were exiting the pool to take refuge in the condo, my wife points toward the beach and says, "Hey, is that ours?" I look up to see our canopy cartwheeling across the beach, over the dunes, and toward the parking lot at the edge of the highway. It gets a bit stuck between two of the dunes, temporarily halting its progress toward the cars it will inevitably damage if it manages to make its way much further. It is at this moment I realize that my phone number is written not just on one, but all four legs of the canopy structure. If it makes its way to the parking lot, I'm sure I will receive a phone call from some unhappy driver. And though Lowe's undoubtedly would have sold me an extended warranty on the canopy, collision was not an option they offered. The thing about flip-flops is that they are not that easy to run in, especially in a 30-mile-per-hour wind. I make my way across the resort, across the highway, defiantly past the "Do Not Walk on Dune" sign, and up over the dunes. Probably just a little damage, I think to myself, just before seeing the canopy take yet another flip, one of the legs collapsing completely, destroying the structure, but graciously stopping its momentum toward the parking lot. There will be no saving it. But abandoning it is no option either, as my name and phone number conspicuously identify me and my would-be litter. It's the Statue of Liberty pose that I begin with as I make my way out across the dunes and toward the trash can in the distance. The fact that the metal frame serves as a very prominent lightning rod on the now mostly deserted beach is not lost on me, and I pick up my gate. Tiring, I swap fairly quickly to the YMCA before discovering that, with one missing leg, I now have yet another way to carry the structure, hugging one of the cross members, one arm above, one below, pushing the canopy in front of me. In retrospect, I suppose this pose could be called the Sisyphus. It is on our last day at the condo that I find the beach umbrella, packed away in the back of the closet of the extra bedroom, free for any occupant to use. It is collapsible, light, and casts just enough shade for my wife, son, and me. Without the bulk of the canopy, our SUV packs a bit more easily as we stow our luggage for the return trip. Before we leave the parking deck, another storm makes its way to shore, more powerful even than the one the previous day. As I turn out of the driveway and point the nose of our vehicle toward Arkansas, the wind blowing the rain in off the Gulf, I notice something out of the corner of my eye. Crumpled and maimed, just the other side of the parking lot, not 20 feet where mine had been the day before, is someone's beach canopy. Poor schmuck.
Mark Isbell lives in North Little Rock with his wife and son. He teaches first-year riding at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and works in his family's business, a multi-generation rice farm in the heart of the Mid-South. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.